right, it is another jam-packed show this Sunday. Before we dive into turkey hunting and muzzleloaders, let's cover some recent tournament archery results. We're kind of coming to the end of indoor target archery season. David, you just shot in Vegas. We kind of forgot to cover it last Sunday, but give me a rundown on that. How'd you do? How was the tournament?
Yeah, so got to shoot in the Vegas World Championships and then what's called the Vegas shoot last week. It is a full week of nothing but archery tournaments. What generally happens is on Wednesday, we have what's called the National Archery in the Schools Program State Shoot. It's all about the school systems, anywhere from elementary school through high school. This is a program using one type of a bow. It is called the Genesis bow with an 1820 arrow. It's the diameter and size of arrow. The goal of the NASH program is to bring youth archers into the sport, and eventually those archers will become competitive archers and hunters.
How does the NASP program work? How does somebody get involved in that?
So you can contact the Department of Wildlife. There is a NASP coordinator, statewide coordinator. Through that, you can either get involved in it if your school has it. So you can contact your school administrator, find out if the NASP program is there, and then you can sign your child into that program. The Department of Wildlife also brings in the homeschool groups. So they'll come in and shoot as well. And then you have your charter schools that are also involved. There's quite a few of those, actually.
We need to talk after the show. Let's discuss this because I know my wife is part of that Biggest Little Explorers homeschool co-op here in town.
Yeah.
And she's been trying to get a homeschool archery group going. I need to make sure I get that information from you.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And I would love to have some more schools involved in the program. What it's doing is introducing the kids to these events. This year, roughly 600 youth archers participated in Las Vegas. There's 23 schools, pretty much all day Wednesday. They come in and they shoot. So, and they absolutely have a blast. Every year, the kids are just cheering each other on. It's a great team event.
Level playing field, right?
Oh, completely.
Because it's the same bow, the same arrows. It's an easy way for people or youth to get into the sport of archery without taking the full deep dive into my own personalized bow, my own setup, all that.
Because a lot of the schools, they receive the bows. The parents aren't having to spend to buy the bow. They can if they wish.
Right.
But they don't have to. I'll bring up one of our kids that shot that wasn't a NASP kid and is now in college with an archery scholarship and has been competing on a world level for the last year.
Oh, very cool. So moving on from NASP, usually then you'd be looking at something like an S3DA program.
Correct.
And that would be Dustin Great is the local coordinator for that, right?
Correct. Yeah.
Or statewide?
Yeah, he's our statewide coordinator for the S3DA program. So yeah, kids can transition into the S3DA program, and that's where we start introducing them to the 3D tournament formats as well as some of the indoor target formats.
Okay.
So it's a progressional thing. Yeah, they just start moving into the next levels.
Just this last week at the shop you and I shoot at, I saw the Bishop Minogue group. It was all Bishop Minogue students. Dustin was there coordinating.
Correct.
So I know Bishop Minogue has a program. I'm sure there are other schools in the area that...
There are quite a few. What we can do, man, we can get Dustin on the show and have him give us a complete rundown of the S3DA program as well as the schools that are involved, because I know he is, along with Nevada Bowhunter Association, working to help S3DA get more involvement in that, because it's a great program. It really is. So after the NASP tournament, then we have the S3DA tournament.
Same place in Vegas.
Yeah, same place.
Okay.
When you're at Vegas, there are roughly, like this year was a registration breaking year. We had almost 4,000 shooters this year. After the S3DA tournament, you have the USA Indoor Archery State of Nevada Championships. Like I said, it is a week long of just shooting. And then we have from there, then we move right on into the Vegas shoot, which the format there is we shoot 3 days and you're shooting what's called a Vegas three spot, 3 arrows and 10 ends. So the top score that you can shoot is a 300 with 30 X's. The X is about the size of a dime.
And N's, for those that don't know, it's a round, basically.
Yeah, basically it's a round. So all the shooters come up to the line. You have 2 minutes to shoot your three arrows, which is tons of time. When you're done shooting one arrow at each target, you stop, you go up, you score your arrows with your group, your bale mates, because there's four people on each bale. You score, you come back, and now you're at this beginning of the second end. So in the objective here is to shoot a perfect 300 with 30 X's. And this year in Las Vegas, when you shoot a 300, you're put into what's called the $10,000 a day challenge. And you have this massive shoot off. It's called a shoot down from whoever shot the 300s down, and the last person gets $10,000.
Okay, I wanted to bring this up because I was looking at the Nevada Bow Hunters Association Instagram page. There was a young woman shot a perfect 322X. Who was that?
This year?
This year. It was just posted on Nevada Bow Hunters
Association. Oh, that was one of our shooters. That's Haley West out of Las Vegas, a youth shooter. She shot youth championship. Absolutely phenomenal shooter.
Well, yeah.
It was her first 300 she had ever shot, and she ended up shooting it in Vegas on Friday. She shot a 322X. Then Saturday, she shot a 298, and Sunday, she shot a 297.
I saw that 300 and went, holy smoke, how do I sign up for private lessons with her?
Right? Just amazing. So just to give you some perspective, on Saturday evening for the $10,000 shoot down, there were over 80 shooters that shot perfect 300s.
Oh, man.
Yeah. And they go down to the very last two individuals, and you have to shoot the first person to shoot an inside out X. Shooting that dime X, and your arrow can't touch the edge of it.
Okay.
So it's kind of like, it'd be similar to a swoosh in basketball where you don't touch the rim. The arrow can't touch the edge.
Okay.
So you want to talk about precision shooting. That's the epitome of it. But anyway, so as you're moving forward, this year there were a total of 27 shooters in the championship division, the men and the women's division. 27 of them shot a perfect 900 round. The two women in the championship, Paige Pierce and Tiana Gillingthing, I always mess her name up, they both shot 900s during the weekend.
That's incredible. Before we go to break here, where did you wind up?
So I shot my best I have. The last 2 years, I've always put a personal goal on myself to shoot, because I just shoot against myself. It's how I can zone everyone out that's around me and just focus on my own shooting. But this year, I shot in the 290s all 3 days, and I wanted to be in the top 10 flights. So there were 42 flights this year. Each flight has 40 people in it, and I ended up in flight 9. So it's it for me. I hit my goal, and next year my goal will be within the top 5 flights and shooting at least one 300 next year. That's my goal.
Very cool. That's a good goal to work toward. Hey, stay tuned. Coming up after the break, we're going to be talking turkey, not just in the state of Nevada, but also in a bordering state. We'll talk hunting in California. We'll get into all of that after the break. This segment, we'll touch briefly on the Vegas archery thing one more time, then we will get into turkey hunting. David, you had a couple things you wanted to bring up we didn't get to in the first segment there.
Yeah.
101, did you say? 101-year-old shooter at Vegas?
This year in Vegas, we had a World War II veteran, 101 years old, that shot competitively at the Vegas shoot. He wasn't in a wheelchair, wasn't cruising around with a walker with tennis balls.
A rascal.
Yeah, right? He was cruising up and down the stairs. He was walking around just like everyone else. I mean, 101 years old, sharp as a tack, and could shoot a bow very well. So that was awesome. They highlighted him during the championship rounds, still out there flinging arrows and just having a great time. Again, no excuses for any of us.
Yeah, right, something there to aspire to, for
right,
sure.
Right, exactly. The Vegas shoot also, they provided $38,000 to the youth for scholarships. They do it every year. It was really cool to see. A lot of kids got some good money for their future education. And this money can go, it's not just for college. You can use the funds for trade school, for anything advancing in learning towards, you know, your future. So, and then the Easton Foundation has also just started a program which is very similar. So if you went to the Easton Foundation scholarship programs, they have programs as well. So it's really cool that they're giving back to the youth in the programs.
Absolutely.
But some of the big stuff is in the championship this year, it was a crazy tight championship. In the men's open competition, the podium for the $57,000 for the men's open as well as the women's open, it went from 29 shooters a shoot down to the top seven. Those top seven shooters shot 100 arrows in the 10. That was how long they shot until they got down to the finals. So 100 shots were within the size of a quarter.
And is that just a stand up and send it one after the other?
Yep. Yeah. Oh. So you do a shoot down is the same thing. You shoot three arrows. If you shoot a nine, you're out because generally someone shot perfect tens.
And as I've learned the hard way, that's why your tournament bow or your indoor archery bow generally is going to be less poundage than an outdoor, like a hunting bow. I shot for a while with a 70 and change compound bow, a hunting bow. I don't care who you are, 100 arrows in a row with a 70-pound hunting bow, you are going to wreck your shoulders. Generally, people are in that 50 to 60-pound range for indoor stuff.
Yeah, 45 to 60 pounds is generally your indoor system. Because this was just during the shoot down. So
not counting what they had done previously.
Right. So you're throwing a lot of arrows. So this year it ended up two previous Vegas champions. One is Bodie Turner. He won his first Vegas at the age of 14. And in the women's division last year, she was 13 years old winning the Vegas tournament. Three top shooters, $57,000, went to Chris Schaefer. And for the women, that's the men's, and the women was Tanja Gillingthien with Paige Pearson second and Kyle Douglas in second for the men. So, and that's 57 grand for the Vegas shoot, but then their sponsors also give them a truckload of money. So some of these went home with anywhere from $70,000 to $80,000 for winning the Vegas tournament.
Performance incentives from manufacturers.
Well, and they get it every day. So if they shoot a perfect 300, their sponsors kick them a little bit of cash. It could be $1,000, $3,000, $5,000. If they shoot a perfect 300, 30X, the check's a little bigger. So there's a big incentive to be able to take home the podium in Vegas.
Yeah, very cool. Yeah. So now here's what I'm itching to get into.
Yeah, you are.
This time of year, my brain goes to turkeys, and I wanted to touch on turkey behavior in Nevada. I'll be the first to admit I am not an expert turkey hunter by any stretch of the imagination. I've hunted them in five or six states. I like hunting them, but I've had the opportunity to hunt with some guys that born with a turkey call in their mouth. So I've learned a little bit along the way, but when you and I were chatting yesterday, you brought up something extremely interesting about turkey hunting in Nevada and their behavior, how it's unlike other states.
Yeah, I've harvested turkeys in other states where, you know, you traditionally, you call them in, you hear them out there a ways, you got the tom all puffed up and strutting, and he's coming in because he's ready for a fight. You know, here's your opportunity. My tags in Nevada have all been out in the Mason Valley area. So those birds, I don't know if it's where there's the population, it's not a really big population, and the toms already have their ladies, as many as they're going to be able to handle. So when you're calling, my experience, again, this is just David's experience, is that when you start calling, they're going the other direction because they don't want to fight, I'm assuming.
The harem is full.
Yeah, the harem's full. So when you start calling, they stop in their tracks and they'll look around and then they go in another direction. That's been my last three or four hunts out in that area. And, you know, you put them to bed at night, you got them up in the tree, you get out there at dark 30, you know, hour or two before sun up, you hunker down somewhere near that tree, and you just have to hope when they come out of that tree, they come out in front of you. Because, again, my experience, when they pop out of that tree and they come into the field, they're heading straight for the thick brush.
And there's no run and gun in that stuff. You can't. Once they're in there, they're gone.
Oh, yeah. That stuff is so thick, you're not spotting and stalking turkeys in some of those areas. You may catch them on the edges of a field here and there, but there have been several mornings where your hunt's done. Once the sun cracks and those turkeys are gobbling up in that tree and they drop out of that tree, your hunt's done in 45 seconds because they land, they just book feet to the brush and then they're gone.
No interest in decoys. They won't decoy like traditional birds.
Not in my experience. Years ago, we used a decoy. We're talking early 2000s.
Okay.
We used a decoy and we did have a tom. Actually, we had a tom and a jake come into the decoy and we shot the tom in that group. That was the only time a decoy actually worked. Other than that, no, it just doesn't. You just kind of got to sit and hope that you get something come across you. And there's times where they're not gobbling. There's no vocalization whatsoever. You're out there and it is like, it's just crickets.
Man, that's weird.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask, what species of turkey do we have?
You were gonna ask me that.
Is it Merriam's or?
So the two species we have in the state of Nevada is the Rio Grande and the Merriam's.
Rios and Merriam's. Okay.
Yeah, Rios and Merriam's.
I'm partial to Rios and Goulds. Goulds being the Mexican turkey. They're a lot bigger than most of our American species. I believe they have them in Arizona, maybe New Mexico.
Arizona, for sure.
Arizona. Okay. I think those are incredible looking birds. They've got the dark body. They're slightly bigger. The real white tips on the fan. I think that's a cool bird. That being said, I feel like I've killed more Rios than just about anything else. But in Nevada, we have Merriam's and Rios. For those lucky few that draw a turkey tag in Nevada, preseason scouting can make or break your season, figuring out where they roost, you know, getting on the X, which is a component to hunting in other states, hunting turkeys in other states as well, but maybe not quite as critical as it is in the state of Nevada. You know, I see turkeys a good bit down there in the Gardnerville area. At the south end, they're crossing back and forth into California, right where the border is there on Highway 88. For those that drew the tag, get out, scout preseason, figure out exactly where they want to come out of the roost, because once, like David said, once they hit the deck, they're gone.
Yeah, and that's my experience, again, is only in the Mason Valley area. I'm not sure how they react in other parts of the states where the tags are available. You know, I've been on hunts in California. You know, they're pretty vocal there.
Right.
You know, Salinas area. You can get on them pretty well. They're fairly aggressive in some situations, and they're a lot of fun to hunt when, you know, you do call and they respond, and then you got this big old tom cruising along all puffed up. It's the coolest thing. I definitely encourage everyone to get out there and definitely try to shoot one with a bow. Coming up after the break, we are going to get into a little bit of turkey hunting in California. So hold on and we'll see you in a bit. And we're back here on Nevada Backcountry. Henry and I are going to now get into a little bit of the Nevada hunt, and then we're going to drop into the California turkey hunt. So in Nevada, the application process has completed. That ended February 7th, right, Henry?
February 7th, I think we looked up.
But if you are still wanting to put in for, say, the bonus points, You can't put in for the draw, but you can still apply for a bonus point, and that runs until February 14th.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that. So you can still buy a bonus point.
Yeah,
that's
you can
cool.
buy a bonus point until February 14th. Then there should be draw results by March. I think the beginning of March, sometime middle of March, you'll know.
Over the break, you and I were talking about where in Nevada turkey populations exist. We talked about the idiosyncrasies of the group out there in Mason Valley. I know I've seen them driving past whatever wildlife area that is just north of Battle Mountain there. I've seen tons of turkeys out there. Where else can people go in the state of Nevada, David?
First off, turkeys were introduced into the state of Nevada in 1960. And since, I think it's been since like 1986, 87, Nevada has worked cooperatively with other states to trap and transplant turkeys all over the state. And right now, you can do some hunting in the Ruby Mountains of Elko County. There are turkeys in Paradise Valley and Humboldt County in the eastern White Pine County area. And then in southern Nevada, there are populations in Lincoln County, as well as Mopa Valley, where some of the Merriams are cruising around. And then the Overton Wildlife Management Area in the Overton area in Clark County.
Okay.
Kind of the main population zones.
I'm glad you brought up working with other states. I would bring up an example, a conservation success story, not really relevant to Western states, but in the state of Maine, and you talk about an inhospitable climate. It's basically Alaska light. They started reintroducing turkeys in the late 90s, mid to late 90s. As of, I want to say 2015, 2016. Now, if you own 20 acres or more in the state of Maine, you don't even need a hunting license. They want you to shoot turkeys. So my hope would be that as Nevada collaborates with other states, that we find ourselves in that situation where we have an abundance of turkeys because, yeah, it's a bird. I like bird hunting, but it is a very cool animal to hunt. And it's about as close as you can get to big game hunting for something with feathers.
Yeah, I didn't know that. That's pretty cool. If you just own 20 acres, you can just
whack them. It's like coyotes in the state of Nevada. Yeah, they want you to shoot them.
Wow. Nevada has such low densities of turkeys. You know, and this is due to predators and poor habitat conditions due to, you know, our
water situation,
our drought conditions. That has an extreme effect on a lot of these turkey populations. You know, we may have 4 or 5 years of a drought, which can really affect and decimate a turkey population. And then we end up having some great years like this year. I mean, with the amount of snow we're getting this year across the entire state, you know, when we were driving into Vegas for the tournament last week, we had snow from Hawthorne. We drove through Pahrump, but we had snow going up and over the hill into Vegas, driving down from Pahrump off that mountain, driving down.
Yeah.
It was awesome.
This is a good one, and I hope it benefits the animals. If it continues too far into spring, I know there will be some issues there. But, yeah, I hope it benefits animals. I hope it benefits turkeys because I like turkey hunting. You know, again, I'm no expert turkey hunter. I definitely have found myself taking more than my fair share of naps under a tree on a nice warm spring day, only to wake up a couple hours later and go, oh, well, that happened. I guess I'll go home now.
Well, so, I'm a nervous netty, man. I'm probably a really bad turkey hunter because I can't sit very long. If anyone knows me, I'm like a jumping bean. So if I see something out there a ways, I'm like, let's do this. And I'm off on the stalk and it usually ends poorly, but very beneficial for the animal, but poorly for me. So I'm generally back, you know, at camp pretty quick.
The world's best conservationist.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Now that was a good one. All right. I'm gonna spin. Hey, I'm gonna coin that one.
Hey, I like it. When it comes to big game stuff, I'm like you. I like to be moving. There is something, especially in California. So as I alluded to earlier, somebody made a comment on our Facebook page about Nevada catering to Californians. Well, hey, let's throw it back on them. Nevadans, people listening right now, go hunt California for turkey. It's over the counter. It's not a draw system. You can kill turkeys in the spring in California. It's over the counter. I do switch gears during turkey season. There's something about springtime. Everything's green. Birds are chirping. You know, the whole picturesque scene. And I have found myself posted up under a tree taking a nap at 6 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, it's not a bad thing. You know, it's not a bad thing. I've been on plenty of turkey hunts in California where the feral pigs come out and chase off the turkeys, which...
Yeah, and I wanted to bring up, in California, here's one of the things I really like about it. As opposed to other states, I've hunted the Southeast, I've hunted Texas, hunted Maine. In California, the birds seem extremely receptive to calling. I don't know if that's a pressure thing. I'm not sure what that is. But again, it's a type of turkey hunting I like to do. And I would encourage people to look up some areas. It is a short drive, you know, from my house to set up on turkeys in California, Placerville area. There are plenty of turkeys there. A little more densely populated, so you need something like OnX to successfully hunt. You need to know where those property boundaries are, but there is plenty of lumber company land over there.
Yeah, that you can lease.
I didn't know you could lease it.
Yeah, some of them, you can lease. It's similar to, if anyone's hunted Oregon, I've gone to Oregon and hunted blacktails there, and you can acquire some of these logging company leases because they'll have X amount of plots that they'll eventually someday log.
Okay.
But until then, you can have a hunting lease on it. We did it for years until finally the one plot that we were leasing, they canceled our lease because they were logging it that next year.
Okay.
But until then, we got to hunt it for years for bear and for blacktail. It was awesome. Awesome hunting.
Very cool. So yeah, you could get in touch with the lumber company and see about leasing. I know some of the ones I'm thinking of in particular, they have a walk-in only regulation. You cannot camp, can't stay overnight, but you can walk in, hunt them. And we're talking about thousands upon thousands of acres. You walk far enough back in there, do a little digital scouting on Google Earth or whatever, and you'll find valleys, clearings, meadows back in there that you can walk into and hunt. It's not necessarily public land, but it is as close to public as you're going to get in the private realm.
Yeah. And to go back on that, we're catering to California hunters.
Did that one stick in your craw?
It really does, because a lot of people say that. You know, granted, okay, California borders us the most.
Right.
So, of course, you're going to feel that California, we're catering to California or non-residents. Hunters and sportsmen have to understand 10% of Nevada's tags go towards non-resident tags. If you're a resident of the state of Nevada, that does not affect you at all. So if you're putting in for area, hypothetically area 16 for deer, and there's also promotion to get some more out-of-state people to start applying for non-resident tags, that's not taking away from your resident allocated tags. They're just putting in for the 10% of the draw for non-residents. It's not taking away from your chance of getting a tag.
I kind of just shrug my shoulders when people say that, because I've hunted deer in California, hunted turkeys in California.
Yeah, you can hunt that over the counter. You can hunt
over the counter
deer over the counter in California, just north of us outside of Susanville. I mean, if you want to, you can go there, go over the counter, grab a tag, and boom, you're in the field in an hour and a half.
Why sit around and be miserable and complain about the system here? I kind of look at it as, okay, if I don't draw, fair enough. I'll get an over-the-counter tag. I can hunt. There's plenty of border units with Nevada, so it's not like you're commuting a long ways.
No.
You can go hunt right over the border, buy an over-the-counter tag in California. There are an abundance of turkeys over there. It's over-the-counter. It's relatively affordable. So you didn't draw in Nevada? Go hunt California.
Or Oregon. Oregon's got plenty of over-the-counter.
Yeah.
So, and we can get into that in another segment someday, is the over-counter tags that within half a day drive from us. There's a lot.
A ton of them.
A lot of them.
Stay tuned to 99.1 and 92.3 FM Talk. After the break, we're going to have a special guest, Jerry Evans. We're going to talk a little bit about muzzleloader hunting here on Nevada Backcountry. final segment here on Nevada Backcountry, a special guest, the world's okayest hunter, Jerry Evans. We're going to talk a little bit about muzzle loaders. So why don't you tell us a little bit about your experience just this last season in Idaho hunting elk with a muzzle loader?
Well, first and foremost, I am no expert on muzzle loaders or muzzle loader hunting. I will tell you my experience with it, which has been, in one particular case, to step back to about 4 years ago, I won the Powerball of hunting tags with a tag in Utah. I got a tag. Anybody is familiar or heard about the world record spider elk that was taken, I think it was in 2008. Well, about 4 years ago, I put in first time ever on Monroe Mountain in Utah with a muzzleloader, and I was encouraged to do that by Wade Lemon. Unfortunately, his claim to fame right now is he's facing some charges because he took Donald Trump Jr. on a bear hunt, and apparently there was some baiting or something to that effect. But anyway, to Monroe Mountain, world record spider elk, I get a tag there putting in for the very first time.
And you did it on your first shot?
Yes, very first shot. I remember one of the guides that was taking me out on the hunt called and asked how long I'd been putting in for, and told him first year, and he said, "Geez, Jerry, it takes us 24 years to draw."
Did you have to do anything special for the muzzle loader? What were the regs in Utah hunting with one, or is it a similar setup to Nevada?
Similar to Nevada, but you cannot use magnification. And I do have an opinion. I do think that you should be able to use a scope on a muzzle loader. That's just my opinion. What I did on that particular hunt, I got some high bases and I put basically a red dot scope on it. And so I could, and I practiced out to 200 yards, which is quite a poke with a muzzle loader.
Yeah.
High bases. I could still see my open sight. And, but then I could also get out there to 200 yards with a red dot. You can't use magnification, but you can use something like that, which I thought would have come in real handy. Fortunately, I didn't need it. Now, fast forward to Idaho, and I joked with my other son when he told me what I had to do, and I said, do I need a coonskin cap too? A bag of possibles? But you really have to primitize your muzzleloader. Mine is a Knight muzzleloader. Great company too. If you need support, help, questions, and that sort of thing, they're there for you and they get back to you really quickly. And also with the powder in Utah, you're not restricted. You can use those Pyrodex pellets.
Right, right.
Powder. Okay. And I switched from Pyrodex pellets that I had had for a long time. Here's what you have to do. And you can, if you've got a muzzleloader already, something like a Thompson or a Knight or whatever it may be, you have to use open sights. You have to use a lead bullet or a round ball lead bullet. You can't use a Sabo, which I did in Utah. You can't use a 209 primer. I forget the term for the primer that I used. And fortunately, the breech plug, when I bought the Knight, it came with two different breech plugs, and the other breech plug was what I used to stick the little primer on. The lead bullet, there's one for you. It can't be jacketed. So it is just a big chunk of lead. Got mine here locally, a 385 grain Hornady lead bullet.
So basically, when you're hunting with a muzzleloader in whatever state it may be, it's really imperative that you get into the regs and find out exactly, because it sounds like it could be like a little bit of a difference between one state to another. Like you were stating, you can't use 209 primer in this state, but you can use it in the state next to it. Making sure that you know what your regulations are for the hunt that you're actually going on within the state that you're going to.
Exactly. And loose powder too. Now, I had switched to loose powder, stayed with loose powder on this particular hunt. So that is, you're really hunting, it doesn't have to be a 6 foot long barrel, octagon barrel, and a flintlock or anything. It's fairly making it more primitive than your standard muzzleloader, which is pretty good. And some of them can really reach out there. There are a few states where you can use scopes. But the good thing about, the positive thing about muzzleloading, and yeah, you're right, Dave, you got to check the regs and make sure first, if you want to do it and can do it, primatize your current muzzleloader or get another one, but it does allow you to apply for hunts where typically, and I'm speaking of elk in particular, you have a much better chance of getting a tag during the rut. Henry has been on an elk hunt with me during the rut here in Nevada, and bull of a lifetime at 103 yards with a muzzleloader, the dead bull, with a bow just a bit out of my range.
I do have one muzzleloader question. So I follow quite a few hunting pages, and every year you've got a few individuals getting on there that have gone on a muzzleloader hunt, and they are stating they shot their mule deer or their elk at 300, 400 yards with iron sights in Nevada with a muzzleloader. What's the reality there? I mean, that just sounds like absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah, I think the saying is I call BS on that.
Yeah.
There may be some people that can do that. Open sight, that would be quite a poke. I have heard of people getting out there 400 yards or so with muzzleloader, but that's with a scope. Andy at Legacy Sports, president of Legacy Sports here locally, there's a guy back in Pennsylvania that takes their actions somehow or another, creates a muzzleloader out of it and puts a scope on it, and they do get out there a long, long way. As you said before, you got to check the regs, and that's one of the first things I would do. Can you use optics, any kind of optics? Because in Utah, like I said, it was not a magnified, I think it was a vortex red dot, but it helped to put that little dot on the target out there 200 yards, where with my eyesight, it was even hard to get sighted in at 100 yards. I can see things at 100 yards, but when you're shooting at a shoot-and-see target and trying to put it right in dead center, even at the range on a sled or a bag, it's kind of hard to focus on one or the other, either the target or the sights. I'm fairly nearsighted and left eye dominant, but I shoot right-handed. 300-yard shot, muzzleloader, it could be done. I couldn't do it. There's a whole lot of drop, especially when you're shooting something that's on the lighter range with a sabo at 200 grains or 250 grains. Try a 385-grain bullet, and you're basically throwing a big rock at it.
I was going to back up. I might catch some heat for this. I disagree. You said you think you should be able to hunt with a magnified scope on a muzzleloader, and I was going to disagree with you on that. I think the reason that a muzzleloader tag is easier to draw or there are more available is because of the success rate. It's not just an arbitrary number someone comes up with and says, hey, we have X amount of tags. Yeah, sure, let's do that. I think if you allowed people to hunt with a scope on a muzzleloader, eventually we would see tag numbers or tag allocations drop to where it's nothing more than another rifle draw.
You have a valid point there. Hunting today is getting to that point where that's that balance that the magic and the voodoo that wildlife agencies have to do. And when they allocate tags, you know, they, and Dave knows more about this than I do, they don't allocate tags knowing that there will be a 100% success rate. And so I think there's some crazy regulations like the let off on a bow now that can't exceed, I'm not sure, 85-90%. And now there are bows that you can adjust the let off. But in today's world, with today's technology, with optics and everything, I think Swarovski has a scope. Scopes are practically electronic.
I believe that's Burris, the Burris Eliminator, where you, you're absolutely right. You push a button, it lases the animal or sends out that infrared beam or whatever it is, ranges it for you, and the crosshairs automatically adjust to where you need to hold. I think that stuff is cool. I just would be worried that if we allowed optics on muzzle loaders, instead of a 30% success rate or 25% success rate, you'd start to see that 60, 75% success rate. And then next thing you know, you have a state agency saying, well, now instead of 100 tags, there's only 50 available.
Correct.
Yeah, and you know, it could be something where, just to circle back to Idaho and that cow elk that I took and that particular tag, maybe it could be something to where if it's late December or January, then you can use a scope.
Hey, thank you everybody for tuning in. That will do it for this episode of Nevada Backcountry. Coming up next is Tom Gresham's Gun Talk on 99.1 and 92.3 FM Talk.